I asked him to look at her closely, to look deeply into her eyes and to see if he recognized her as someone in his current life. "No," he sadly answered. "I don't know her." "Do you know your name?" I asked, returning his attention completely to that ancient lifetime in Palestine. He pondered this question. "No," he finally said. "I will tap you on the forehead as I count backward from 3 to 1. Let your name just pop into your mind, into your awareness. Whatever name comes to you is fine." No name popped into his mind. "I don't know my name. Nothing comes to me. But something came to me, popping into my mind like a silent explosion, suddenly clear and vivid. Eli," I said aloud. "Is your name Eli? How do you know that?" He responded from the ancient depths. "That is my name. Some call me Elihu, and some call me Eli. How do you know? Were you there too?" "I don't know," I answered truthfully. "It just came to me." I was very surprised at the whole situation. "How did I know?" "I have had psychic or intuitive flashes before, but not often. This felt as if I were remembering something rather than receiving a psychic message." "Remembering from when?" I could not place it. My mind stretched to remember, but I could not. I knew from experience that I should stop trying to remember. Let it go, get on with the day. The answer would probably arrive spontaneously in a while. An important piece of some strange puzzle was missing. I could feel its absence, hinting at a crucial connection still to be found. But a connection to what? I tried, not very successfully, to concentrate on other things. Later that evening, the puzzle piece arrived suddenly and very softly in my mind. All at once, I was aware of it. It was Elizabeth. About 2 months ago, she had recounted a tragic but touching lifetime as a potter's daughter in ancient Palestine. Her father had been killed accidentally by Roman soldiers after they dragged him around from the back of a horse. The soldiers had not really cared what happened to him. His mangled body, his bleeding heel, had been cradled by his daughter as he died in the dusty street. She had remembered his name in that lifetime. His name was Eli. My mind was working quickly now. The details of the two Palestinian lifetimes fit together. Pedro's and Elizabeth's memories of that time meshed perfectly. Physical descriptions, events, and names were the same. Father and daughter. I have worked with many people, usually couples, who have found themselves together in previous lives, may have recognized their soul companions, traveling together through time to be united once again in the current lifetime. Never before had I encountered soulmates who had not yet met in the present time. In this case, soulmates who had traveled nearly 2,000 years to be together again. They had come all this way. They were within inches and minutes of each other, but they had not yet connected. At home, with their charts filed away in my office, I tried to remember if they had shared other lifetimes. No. Not as monks. One story but not two, at least not yet. Not on the India trading routes, not in the mangrove swamps of Florida, not in the malarial Spanish Americas, not so far in Ireland. These were the only lifetimes I could remember. Another thought dawned. Perhaps they had been together in some or all of those times but had not recognized each other, because they had not met in the present. There was no face, no name, no landmark in the present life, no one to connect to the people in previous incarnations. Then I remembered Elizabeth's Western China. The time-worn sweeping plains where her people were massacred and where she and a few other young women were captured. On these same plains, which Pedro pinpointed as Mongolia, he had returned to find his family, his kin, his people destroyed. Pedro and I had assumed that his young wife had been killed amid the chaos, destruction, and despair described in his recall. She had not. She had been captured and taken away for the rest of a lifetime, never to be held again in the strong arms of her Mongol husband. Now those arms had returned through the hazardous mists of time to hold her again, to hug her sweetly to his breast. But they did not know. Only I knew. Father and daughter. Childhood lovers. Husband and wife. How many more times throughout history had they shared their lives and their love? They were together again, but they didn't know it. Both were lonely, both suffering in their way. Both were starving, and yet a feast had been set before them, a feast they could not yet smell or taste. I was severely constrained by the laws of psychiatry, if not the more subtle rules of karma. The strictest of the laws is that of privacy or confidentiality. If psychiatry were a religion, breaching a patient's confidentiality would be one of its cardinal sins. At the least, the breach could constitute malpractice. I could not tell Pedro about Elizabeth, nor Elizabeth about Pedro. Whatever the karma or spiritual consequences of intervening in another's free will, the consequences of violating psychiatry's main law were quite clear. The spiritual consequences would not have deterred me. I could introduce them and let destiny take its course. The psychiatric consequences stopped me cold. What if I were wrong? What if a relationship between them began, soured, and ended badly? There could be anger and bitterness. How would this reflect back on their feelings about me as their trusted therapist? Would their clinical improvement unravel? Would all their good therapeutic work be undone? There were definite risks. I also had to examine my own subconscious motives. Was my need to see my patients become happier and healthier, to find peace and love in their lives, affecting my judgment now? Were my own needs urging me to cross the boundary of psychiatric ethics? The easy choice would be to leave well enough alone, to say nothing. No harm done, no consequences. When in doubt, do no harm. Whether or not to write many lives, many masters was a similar and very difficult decision. Writing my first book endangered my entire professional career. After 4 years of hesitation, I had decided to write it. Once again, I chose to take the risk. I would intervene. I would try to nudge destiny along. As a concession to my training and to my fears, I would do it as carefully and as subtly as possible. The scenes and details of specific historical epochs remembered by Elizabeth, Pedro, and many of my other patients are very similar to each other. These images are not necessarily like the ones we learned in Sunday school, from history books, or from television. They are similar because they come from actual memories. Carolina Gomez, the former Miss Colombia and first runner-up in the 1994 Miss Universe pageant, remembered in one regression being a naked man pulled to his death by Roman horses. This death is similar to one remembered by Pedro. A few other patients have also remembered horse-drawn deaths, not only in Roman times but, unfortunately, in many other cultures as well. A patient of mine from Colorado remembered being stolen from her Native American tribe and never seeing her family again. She eventually escaped, but she died in the equivalent of a mental ward in the Old West. How similar this is to Elizabeth's experience in Asia. The theme of separation and loss is a common one in past life regressions. We are all seeking to heal our psychic wounds. This need to heal emphasizes the remembering of old traumas, which have caused our pain and symptoms, rather than the remembering of serene and peaceful times, which have not left scars. I occasionally work with two or more people at the same time. When I do this, I do not have either of them speak because they might disturb each other. Recently in my office I regressed a couple simultaneously. Their silent regression took up the entire session, and we had no time to review their experiences. The couple left the office and began to compare notes. Incredibly, they had both experienced a lifetime together. In his lifetime he was a British officer in the 13 colonies, and in hers she was a woman who lived there. They met and fell deeply in love. He was recalled to England and never again returned to visit his love. She was devastated by the loss, and yet there was nothing either one could do about it. Colonial society and the British military followed strict rules and customs. They both saw and described the colonial woman in the same antique clothes. They both described the ship on which he had left the colonies to return to England and the tearful, sad parting that occurred at that time. All the details of their recall matched. Their memories also illustrated problems in their current life relationship. One major problem was her nearly obsessive fear of separation from him and his constant need in return to reassure her that he was not going to leave her. Her fear and his need had no basis in the reality of their current relationship. The pattern had its roots in colonial times. Other therapists performing past life regressions are finding the same results. Traumas arise more frequently than peaceful memories. Death scenes are important because they are often traumatic. Lifetimes seem familiar and important scenes seem similar because the same themes and the same inventions of man have arisen at all times in all cultures. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun, Ecclesiastes 1-9. Chapter 21, believing as I do in the theory of rebirth, I live in the hope that if not in this birth, in some other birth I shall be able to hug all humanity in friendly embrace. Mohandas K. Gandhi. I was wrestling with time, and it had me in a bear hug. Pedro was about to finish his therapy and move permanently to Mexico. If Pedro and Elizabeth did not meet soon, they would be in different countries, and the likelihood of their meeting in this lifetime would be dramatically diminished. Both of their grief reactions were resolving. Physical symptoms, such as quality of sleep, energy levels, and appetite, were better in both patients. Their loneliness and their despair of finding a good and loving relationship remained intact. Anticipating Pedro's termination of therapy, I had reduced the frequency of his appointments to every other week. I did not have much time left. I arranged for their next visits to be sequential, for Pedro to follow Elizabeth in the hourly schedule that day. Everybody entering or leaving my office has to ask through the waiting room. During Elizabeth's session, I worried that Pedro might not come in for his appointment. Things happen, cars break down, emergencies arise, illnesses develop and appointments are changed. He appeared. I walked into the waiting room with Elizabeth. They looked at each other, and their eyes lingered for longer than a moment. I could sense the sudden interest, the hint at worlds of possibilities lying under the surface. Or was this just wishful thinking on my part? Elizabeth's mind quickly reasserted its customary mastery, telling her she needed to leave, cautioning her about appropriate behavior. She turned to the outside door and left the offices. I nodded to Pedro, and we walked into my office. A very attractive woman, he commented, as he sat down heavily in the large leather chair. Yes, I answered eagerly. She's a very interesting person, too. That's nice, he said wistfully. His attention had already begun to wander. He turned to the task of terminating our sessions and moving on to the next phase of his life. He had pushed the brief meeting with Elizabeth out of his mind. Neither Pedro nor Elizabeth followed up on this encounter in the waiting room. Neither asked for more information about the other. My manipulation had been too subtle, too fleeting. I decided to try the back-to-back appointments again, 2 weeks later. Unless I chose to become more direct and to breach confidentiality by speaking directly to one or both of them, this would be my last chance. It was Pedro's final appointment prior to his move. They gazed at each other again as I escorted her to the waiting room. Their eyes met and lingered even longer this time. Pedro nodded and smiled. Elizabeth smiled in return. She hesitated for a moment, then turned to the door and left. Trust yourself, I thought, trying to mentally remind Elizabeth of an important lesson. She did not respond. Again, Pedro did not follow up. He did not ask me about Elizabeth. He was absorbed by the details of his relocation to Mexico, and he ended his therapy on that day. Perhaps this is not to be, I thought. They were both improved, although not happy. Perhaps this was enough. You will not always marry your most strongly bonded soulmate. There may be more than one for you, because soul families travel together. You might choose to marry a less bonded soul companion, one who has something specific to teach you or to learn from you. Your recognition of a soulmate may occur later in life, after both of you are already committed to your present life families. Or your strongest soulmate connection may be to your parent, or to your child, or to your sibling. Or your strongest connection may be to a soulmate who has not incarnated during your lifetime and who is watching over you from the other side, like a guardian angel. Sometimes your soulmate is willing and available. He or she might recognize the passion and the chemistry between you, the intimate and subtle bonds that imply connections over many lifetimes. Yet he or she may be toxic for you. It is a matter of soul development. If one soul is less developed and more ignorant than the other, traits of violence, greed, jealousy, hatred, and fear might be brought into the relationship. These tendencies are toxic to the more evolved soul, even if from a soulmate. Frequently rescue fantasies arise with the thought, I can change him, I can help her grow. If he does not allow your help, if in her free will she chooses not to learn, not to grow, the relationship is doomed. Perhaps there will be another chance in another lifetime, unless he awakens later in this one. Late awakenings do happen. Sometimes soulmates decide not to get married while incarnated. They arrange to meet, to stay together until the agreed upon task is completed, and then to move on. Their agendas, their lesson plans for the entirety of this life, are different, and they do not want to or need to spend all this lifetime together. This is not a tragedy, only a matter of learning. You have eternal life together, but sometimes you may need to take separate classes. A soulmate who is available but unawakened is a tragic figure and can cause you great anguish. Unawakened means that he or she does not see life clearly, is not aware of the many levels of existence. Unawakened means not knowing about souls. Usually it is the everyday mind that prevents awakening. We hear the excuses of the mind all the time. I'm too young, I need more experience, I'm not ready to settle down yet, you are of a different religion, or race, region, social status, intellectual level, cultural background, and so on. These are all excuses, for souls possess none of these attributes. The person may recognize the chemistry. The attraction is definitely there, but the source of the chemistry is not understood. It is delusional to believe that this passion, this soul recognition and attraction, will be easily found again with another person. You do not run into such a soulmate every day, perhaps only one or two more in a lifetime. Divine grace may reward a good heart, a loving soul. Never worry about meeting soulmates. Such meetings are a matter of destiny. They will occur. After the meeting, the free will of both partners reigns. What decisions are made or not made are a matter of free will, of choice. The less awakened will make decisions based on the mind and all its fears and prejudices. Unfortunately, this often leads to heartache. The more awakened the couple is, the more the likelihood of a decision based on love. When both partners are awakened, ecstasy is within their grasp. Chapter 22, Read Me, O Reader, if you find delight in me, because very seldom shall I come back into this world. Leonardo da Vinci. Fortunately, minds more creative than mine were expertly conspiring from lofty heights to arrange a meeting between Elizabeth and Pedro. The reunion was predestined. What happened afterward would be up to them. Pedro was going to New York on business. After a few days there he was to leave for London for 2 weeks of business and vacation before returning to Mexico. Elizabeth was going to Boston for a business meeting and then a visit with her college roommate. They would be traveling on the same airline carrier but at different times. When she reached the gate at the airport, Elizabeth found that her plane to Boston had been cancelled. Mechanical difficulties, she was told. Destiny was at work. She was upset. She would have to call her friend and change the plans. The airline could get her to Newark, and she could catch the shuttle to Boston very early the next morning. She had an important business meeting in the morning which could not be missed. Unbeknownst to her, these new arrangements put her on the same flight as Pedro. He was already there waiting for the flight to be called when she approached the gate. Catching her out of the corner of his eye, he carefully watched her check in at the counter and then take a seat in the waiting lounge. She occupied his attention entirely. He recognized her from their brief encounters in my waiting room. A feeling of familiarity, of interest, overwhelmed him. His concentration was riveted on her as she opened a book. He watched her hair, her hands, how she sat and moved, and she seemed so familiar to him. He had seen her momentarily in the waiting room. But why this level of familiarity? They must have met before the time in the office. He racked his brain to find the hidden memory of where. She felt herself being watched, but this often happened to her. She tried to concentrate on her reading. Concentration was difficult after all the hastily changed plans, but the meditation training had helped. She was able to clear her mind and focus on her book. The feeling of being watched persisted. She looked up and saw him staring at her. She frowned, then smiled when she recognized him from their fleeting encounters in the waiting room. Instinctively she knew this man was safe. But how could she know that? She looked at him for a moment more and then glanced back at her book, now completely unable to concentrate on the pages. Her heart began to beat more quickly, and her breathing accelerated. She knew, beyond any doubt, that he was being pulled by her, that very soon he would approach her. She could feel him coming near. He introduced himself, and they began to talk. The attraction was mutual, immediate, and very strong. Within a few minutes, he suggested that they change their seats so that they could sit together. They were more than acquaintances before the airplane left the ground. Pedro seemed so familiar to her. She clearly knew how he would move, what he would say. Elizabeth had been very psychic when she was a child. The values and beliefs of her conservative Midwestern upbringing had driven her intuitive talent underground. But all of her antennae were up now and at full attention. Pedro could not take his eyes away from her face. He had never been so captivated with someone's eyes before. Hers had such clarity and such depth. Sky blue with a dark blue ring circling them, little hazel islands floating in the blue sea that engulfed him. In his mind, he once again heard the words of the anguished woman wearing the white dress, the woman who had appeared in his recurrent dream. Hold her hand. Reach out to her. He hesitated. He wanted to hold her hand. Not yet, he thought. I hardly know her. Somewhere near Orlando, thunderstorms began to rock the airplane as it plowed through the night sky. The sudden turbulence frightened her, and a brief expression of anxiety swept across her face. Pedro noticed it instantly and his hand grasped hers, to comfort her. He knew it would. The electricity touched his heart in the flush of a moment. Elizabeth could feel lifetimes being awakened by the current. The connection had been made. Listen to your heart, to your own intuitive wisdom, when making important decisions, especially when deciding about a gift of destiny, such as a soulmate. Destiny will deposit its gift directly at your feet, but what you subsequently decide to do with that gift is up to you. If you rely exclusively on the advice of others, you may make terrible mistakes. Your heart knows what you need, other people have other agendas. My father, meaning well but partially blinded because of his own fears, objected to my plans to marry Carol. As I look back, Carol was one of destiny's wonderful gifts, a soul companion across the centuries, appearing again like a beautiful rose, blooming in its season. Our problem was our youth. We met when I was only 18, having just finished my freshman year at Columbia. Carol was 17, about to begin college. Within a few months we knew we wanted to be together always. I had no desire to see anyone else. Despite warnings from family that we were too young, that I did not have enough experience to make such a critical life decision. They did not understand that my heart had the experience of uncounted centuries, that it was certain beyond any rational comprehension. It was inconceivable that we would not be together. My father's agenda became clear. If Carol and I married and had a child, I might have to leave school, and my hopes of becoming a physician would be dashed. In fact, this had happened to my father. He had been a pre-medical student at Brooklyn College during World War II, but my birth had forced him to work after he left military service. He never returned to medical school, and his dreams of becoming a physician never materialized. These dreams remained a bitterly unfulfilled potential, hovering nearby, gradually attaching to his sons. Love dissolves fear. Our love gently dissolved his fears and the projection of his fears onto us. Eventually we were married after my first year of medical school, when Carol was graduated from college. My father came to love Carol as a daughter, and he blessed our marriage. When your intuitions, your gut feelings, your spiritual heart all know beyond any doubt, do not be swayed by the fear-based arguments of others. Sometimes meaning well, and sometimes not, there might lead you far astray from your joy. Chapter 23, It is not more surprising to be born twice than once, everything in nature is resurrection. Voltaire. Elizabeth called me from Boston. She had extended her vacation. Pedro had returned from London immediately after his business there was concluded. He was in Boston, too, to be with Elizabeth. They were already falling in love. They had begun to compare their experiences of past lives, which they both remembered vividly. They were discovering each other, once again. "He really is special," she commented. "So are you," I reminded her. "Following my experiences with Elizabeth and Pedro, my practice has taken an indescribably beautiful leap into the mystical and magical. When I conduct large workshops in which each participant is presented with the opportunity to experience deeply relaxed and hypnotic states, the frequency of magical events rises dramatically. The range of experiences extends far beyond past lives and reincarnation. Beautiful spiritual and mystical events emerge frequently and with life-transforming power. I have been blessed to help facilitate these events. Here is what happened in 1 2-week span. A reporter for a local newspaper attended a weekend series of seminars and workshops in Boston. She wrote the following. "Many people invite past life regression workshops related profound emotional and spiritual experiences. One exercise was particularly dramatic. Vice had the lights turned down and asked everyone in the room to find a partner. He directed the pairs to look into each other's faces for several minutes while he guided the meditation with his voice. When the exercise was over, two women who had never met shared that they'd each seen themselves as the other's sister. One woman said she kept seeing a nun in her partner's face. When she told her partner this, the woman replied that in the previous day's session she'd had a past life memory in which she was a nun. Most amazing was a local woman who saw in her partner's face her 19-and-1/2-year-old brother who'd been killed in World War II. Her partner was a younger woman from Wisconsin who explained that she had also had a past life memory the day before, that of being a 19-and-a-half-year-old man in army boots and fatigues, killed in a war that had to be earlier than Vietnam. The healing experienced by the local woman was palpable in the room. Love dissolves anger," said Vice. "That's the spiritual part. Valium doesn't do it. Prozac doesn't do it. And love heals grief." The brilliant psychotherapist, cellular biologist, and author, Dr. Joan Borisenko, was standing next to me, responding to my keynote address, Spiritual Implications of Past Life Therapy, given at the Boston Conference. Her blue eyes danced as she related a 10-year-old story. At that time, she was a highly respected researcher on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. During a conference on nutrition at a Boston hotel, at which Joan was one of the speakers, she happened to run into her boss, who was attending a medical conference at the same hotel. He was surprised to see her there. Back at work, her boss threatened her. If she ever again lent the name of Harvard University to such a frivolous affair as a nutrition conference, she would not be working at Harvard anymore. Times have changed enormously since then, even at Harvard. Not only is nutrition now a mainstream area of teaching and research, but some faculty members at Harvard are confirming and expanding on my work with past life regression therapy. The next weekend I conducted a 2-day seminar in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Nearly 500 people attended, and again there was magic. Many people experienced early childhood, in utero, and past life memories. One participant, a forensic psychiatrist well respected in Puerto Rico, experienced even more. During a guided meditation on the second day of the conference, his inner eye perceived the shadowy figure of a young woman. She approached him. "Tell them I am well," she directed him. "Tell them Natasha is well." The psychiatrist felt very silly as he related his experience to the entire group. After all, he knew nobody named Natasha. The name itself is a rarity in Puerto Rico. And the message related by the ghost-like girl had no connection to anything happening in the conference or in his personal life. "Does the message have any meaning to anybody here?" the psychiatrist asked the audience. Suddenly a woman screamed in the back of the auditorium. "My daughter, my daughter?" Her daughter, who had died suddenly in her 20s, only 6 months before, was named Anna Natalia. Her mother, and only her mother, called her Natasha. The psychiatrist had never met nor heard of Natasha or her mother. He was as unnerved by this extraordinary experience as was the mother. When both had regained their composure, Natasha's mother showed him a photo of her daughter,